Blog Talk Radio.
Analytic and holistic approaches to fine art education, a comparative approach. Contents. 1.
And now a brief word from our sponsor, Reality Books, publisher of Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A short extract from the book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. God will not change the condition of a people until they change what is in themselves. In other words, until they change their way of thinking. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution is designed to help African Americans and other ethnicities change their way of thinking. This is a book that will change America, and it is on sale for only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. You can order your book now by sending a text message to area code 706-399-5006. Please put your name and the number of books that you would like to order, and you will be contacted to arrange payment information so that the book can be mailed to you immediately. So please go ahead and don't hesitate. Order your copy today. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, published by Reality Books. The author of this book is the great-grandson, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, the founder of the famous Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, now known as Tuskegee University. The great-grandson of Booker T. Washington is inviting you to order his book. Send a text to area code 706-399-5006. The book is only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. Order your copy today. Thank you. And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006.
Well, good evening, good evening, good evening, everyone, and welcome again to Booker T. Washington African American Family Room Forum. And I do want to apologize for the technical difficulties that we had last Saturday, which were completely beyond your host's control. But we're here, we're back, and everything should go as we would like this evening. The problem I had last week is I was told that you could hear me, but I couldn't turn your mics on from my studio dashboard. For some reason, I was blocked from being able to do that. But it's all taken care of now. All your mics are turned on at this time. So with that in mind, we'll go ahead and begin our program, welcoming everyone, our regular panelists, and those who are listening via the internet. And before we get started, well, first of all, I do want to ask my co-host, Mr. Pianchi, for a radio check. Mr. Pianchi, are you able to hear me?
Ele, ele, boom, ya, ke, akwaba. Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, tu escuches muy bien. You can hear me very well, I hope.
Boko, boko. You got some noise on there, though. Somebody's making noise.
I hear a little bit of interference. So I'm going to ask if you are aware of any noise in your background, those who are actually dialing in, and I know who you are, please mute your phone while we're listening. Until you get ready to speak, and then that way we can get the noise eliminated. Okay, well, I want to first of all begin by thanking everyone who has come on board tonight for the program, our regular panelists. We hope to have others that will join us from our regular group a little bit later. But all of you who are listening via the internet, and according to the stats that I see weekly, we generally have three times more people listening via the internet than we have actually on the show. And there may be others. I don't know if I'm getting all the data, but I can see those that download the streaming audio. And so we invite you and we encourage you to dial in so that you can participate where we can actually hear what you think. The number to dial in is 657-383-0671, and I did face this. I did place this announcement on Facebook today. So maybe some of you who saw the Facebook announcement, you have the phone number already. But I do plan to repeat it in just a few minutes. So let's go ahead and get started. Tonight's topic: white American nationalists, white nationalist Americans, which can be also, I suppose, equated with the term right-wing extremists or white supremacist Americans, are attempting to rewrite United States of America history to hide the terrible truth concerning their, meaning the white American supremacists, their horrific, inhumane treatment of black, brown, red, and yellow people in the nation since its inception. How can this be stopped? Now, let me add a little caveat to that. First of all, I'm very well aware of the history of America. I teach this at the university level, and I'm continuously doing research to improve my knowledge base of what actually happened by reading primary sources that have been generated since almost the very beginning of the American experience. So there's no question historically about the way brown, red, and yellow people have been treated within the context of the United States of America since its inception. That's not up for debate. That's a historical fact. The question is this attempt to rewrite the United States of America history to hide this truth something that can be stopped and should it be stopped. Now, I would say this, and I'm going to turn it over to my co-host to begin the discussion, because we certainly welcome our co-host, Ms. Pianchi, and Brother Warren, and also Sheikh Don Kenneth Bay, who have already arrived. So we definitely want to hear your response. But let me just say this one thing. When I was a child back in the 40s, I started grade school, or actually kindergarten, I suppose, in 1948, at the age of 4 years old, and first grade in 1949, at the age of 5 years old. I was an early starter. I went to a parochial school that allowed us to enter first grade at 5 years old, so I did. And beginning with my first grade experience, we began to be taught American history. But what we were taught was basically, I'm sure, for the purpose of giving us a sense of pride in being Americans. But we weren't taught anything in the first, second, or third grade, as I can recall, about the African-American people, the black people in America. We weren't even taught about the history of the importation of black people as slaves. I think we probably got that starting around the fourth grade, maybe. And then we were just taught, you know, some very basic facts, but not a lot of history about what the slaves contributed to the building of America or anything like that. But fortunately, I came from an education focused family. Most of my relatives, my antecedents on my mother's side, going all the way back to Booker T. Washington, were educators. And so my grandmother, who I grew up living with part of my early life, was a school teacher, and she loved history. And so she had three books really that she encouraged me to read. One, of course, was my great-grandfather's autobiography, which gave a background concerning our people's early history in America and, of course, what it was like from his experiences as a slave himself and so forth. And then another book, which was World's Great Men of Color by historian J.A. Rogers, and the other was Sex and Race by J.A. Rogers. So as a very young person, I won't say I started reading those books when I was five, but by the time I was eight, my grandmother had almost demanded that I read Up from Slavery, and then she gave me these other books during that time frame to read. Had I not had that encouragement and help from my grandmother, it probably would have been quite a number of years down the road, so to speak, before I learned anything about what we call today black history or African-American history. Where I did learn a lot was when I got to be around 9 years old, somewhere between 9 and 10 years old. I would venture from my grandmother's house to the campus of Tuskegee Institute because we lived right across the street from the main gate to the campus. And in the George Washington Carver Museum, which was named in honor of Dr. Carver, who taught at Tuskegee for many years, there on the ground floor was an exposition with a lot of gifts that had been given by different people, including African chiefs. And there were a lot of other replicas, like there was a set of uniforms from the Buffalo Soldiers, et cetera, et cetera. But they also had a panoramic display with, believe it or not, paper mache model figures. They couldn't have been any more than about 7 inches tall, but they were in very fine detail and painted that showed the history of the diaspora and going up into the early 1950s, or at least the late 1940s, the significant things that had happened in African-American history. And each one of these visual displays had a placard that explained what the demonstration, what the little presentation was all about. And that's how in addition to the books that my grandmother encouraged me to read, I got my Black History lessons. I would have not had those lessons if it hadn't been for what Tuskegee had done, making that information available, because the school did not teach that, and most of the public schools back in the 40s just did not teach us anything. And then, of course, because of the Civil Rights Movement, Black Power Movement, et cetera, starting in the 70s, there's a big push to teach us our history. And that really got me enthusiastic, because I learned a lot as a child up at the Tuskegee Institute. So when I went to college in the 60s, I became fascinated by the study of history and wanted to get deeper into the history of our people. And so I eventually got a university degree in African-American history. But the point of it is that a lot of the things that we learn, because they are true, do not reflect very well on those people that had us in bondage or their descendants for many, many, many years. And a lot of this old, what I would say, apparent hostility towards us learning about our history coming back. And so to close out, what I want to begin by saying is, we talked a couple of weeks ago about this situation with the professor of journalism at the University of North Carolina, Nicole Hannah Jones, whose tenure progress has been held up. And just to say this quickly, what I learned in doing some research is that there's an individual on the Board of Trustees who has the authority and whose job it is to sign off on tenure or recommendations from the faculty and the department administration. But this person was influenced by another trustee who had received correspondence from one of the donors. And, you know, at the PWI's predominantly white institution, that's one of the primary roles of the trustees, is to find donors to help bring money to the university. So one of the donors apparently had contacted a trustee and was objecting when this donor found out that tenure for this individual was being considered, was objecting to this person getting tenure because of her promotion of, involvement with, and actually generation of what's called the 1619 Project. Now, somebody else can get into more detail about it, but I know something about it. I've done some research on it, but I'm not going to take up the time of the panel right now to go into the detail. But the main thing about it is situates the American experience from the lens of the slave experience. And that's not a pretty picture. It's not a beautiful picture. It's not a good picture. And some people don't want that picture to be on the mural of America's beautiful experience going all the way back to the 1600s. They don't want that part of the picture to be on that presentation. But she made it a point to get the New York Times. I don't know if she was actually a employee of the New York Times, but she got the New York Times, gentleman who was the editor of the New York Times, to agree with her that this was a good thing they needed to print. So they printed a special edition of their New York Times magazine dedicated to this. She wrote an extensive monograph concerning it, but she also got other colleagues, people that she knew had some background. They weren't all historians. They were poets and other creative writers and some other journalists to write articles, basically all lined up with this proposal that she wanted to present concerning giving light 1619, because in August of 2019, that was the commemorative 400-year anniversary of the 1619 importation of these first African people to work in some capacity. We are told by some they weren't really slaves, but they certainly weren't truly free in the colony in Virginia. And so this commemoration was an event that she wanted to have recognized and also to have it publicized through this 1619 Project. So there's been a lot of pushback, and I'll conclude by saying some of it may be valid, only because I'm an historian, and I do know a little bit because I also have a degree in creative and professional writing, and I do know that there's a certain form of journalism that involves creative writing where people actually embellish actual facts with some creativity. There are historians that really decry that. There are journalists, schools that do not want their students to write like that. I understand both sides of that issue. As a historian, I've been trained to be very critical, to make sure that everything is printed with some attribution, with valid, credible attribution, and there's no room for embellishing what actually happened with some imagination or some color that may make the story more fascinating. I know that, and I know why some of the historians have a real problem. And that's one of the charges that has been made concerning Ms. Jones, is that she doesn't have the academic background to be a professor, tenure professor at that university. She doesn't have a doctorate, and that her work leaves something to be desired in terms of actual historical credibility. But she's not an historian. She was hired as a journalist, and that is something that does fall within the realm of journalism, even though it has been criticized. But my concern, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Conkey now, is that this whole discussion, this whole thing, pushback, is opening the door for what I consider to be a possible muzzling of freedom of expression, a freedom of academic freedom on the part of those that want to tell the true story. So enough by me. Ms. Priyanka, what do you think?
Well, Mr. Watson, like I've told you before, you know, and one thing you may mention, a white nationalist. White nationalist is defined as a white person that has a strong affirmation for his country. That could be adjectized either with black, red, or whatever, but that's what it's defined. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't see anything wrong with it. No, people have described themselves as black nationalists, pan-Africanists, or not. So now on the other thing, there's nothing stopping people from teaching their children whatever they want them to be taught. When you talk about a public school, many states, the state statute spelled out, and I know Missouri well, spelled out that the local school board, which is the parents, can dictate the curriculum, textbooks, and the instructional material. I've been at school districts, Normandy school district there in St. Louis County, when they was getting ready to go to a new social studies book. And the publishers of different social studies books, history books, brought samples of what they had and they wanted to offer the district. Those samples were on display either in the library or the lunchroom, where people could come in and view them, examine them, and fill out a card giving their approval or their opinion on the books themselves. I questioned one book because of the information that was in it that was inaccurate, especially when it talked about some of the things that I knew very well on. And I got support from then at the time, the president of ASCAT, Association for the Study of the Classical African Civilization, and Zinga Rabichi, before she died, she sent me a letter to support what I was telling the board that was wrong with the book that they was using. But the Missouri state statute gives parents, the people of a district, the right to have whatever they want. I don't care for the 1619 Project is something that I want my children to be exposed to. I think if people want to apply that, they can apply that themselves. I don't think you should force anything, outsiders should force anything onto a school district. As I said before, the school district is supposed to be controlled by the parents of that district. In the St. Louis Public School District, you got Somalians, you got Bosnians, you got Afghans, you got Russians. You may have a member of each of those ethnic groups sitting in a classroom. So there's no way in the world you can cover in depth any aspects of their history within a given amount of time. I see at Howard University, Howard University has a middle school. Are you aware of that, Mr. Washington?
No, I'm not surprised, but I really wasn't. I've heard you mention that before, though, so I am aware of it since you have mentioned it in the past on the program.
Well, what you do, you have universities like Howard that try to have some input in the learning of children that will possibly enter their complex at some point in time as a choice of universities. And what they have been witnessing is that these children are prepared. At any one given point in time, you only had five historical black colleges, usually Morehouse, Howard, Spelman, and two of them, I can't think of their name, that has a graduation rate above 50% in 6 years, which means that a parent or the cost of education is going to cost 50% more than it normally should under a normal course load. So apparently they had some teachers there that was teaching black history outside of the curriculum that was given to them, and they got fired. Now, when you have a sponsoring university, a sponsoring entity of a school, well, that's just it. They sponsor that university, or that school, I'm sorry. They sponsor that school, and they set the material by which the students learn under the guidance of the university in order to prepare them for the course load when they enroll so that they will be successful. So as far as my opinion on that, I don't think that anybody has tried to deny. I think that you got instances where in school district, the parents just don't take active participation as you want. We got a high school in the St. Louis area, Normie, where the academic performance in math is less than 5% for a student body of over 900 students. In reading, it's about 10%. Well, with that type of performance, academic performance, they're not going to be reading hardly anything. And it shouldn't be like that. And then you got some that have reading a performance in 90%, math performance in 70, 75, 80%. So what tells you there is that you got more due diligence that's coming out of parents and those that supposed to be looking out the best interest for their children, and they are doing just that. Thus, the data shows. That's my initial opinion on your question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was very, 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 very well presented, and I'm sure we all learned something, and I certainly appreciate you beginning the program with that presentation. So we're going to move on around the virtual family room and invite Brother Warren's comments. So what do you think, Brother Warren?
I want to say greetings, Brother Warren, host of New Orleans Wake Up, where we always appreciate being allowed to participate in your outstanding structure of discussion here on the Blog Talk Forum. We just did a show today entitled U.S. Military Racism and Discrimination is Systemic, and that was a great show. I want to stick to the issue that you raised, because sometimes I think people, they don't do that. Yes, there is a movement among many whites to make the discussion of atrocities committed against black and native peoples not to talk about it, as they have always attempted to do. And Mr. Washington, let me explain why this is the case. The truth about atrocities against blacks and Native Americans interferes and contradicts the narrative that white people have constructed that present themselves as being heroes and saviors of the world. You see, in racism, white racism, not only do whites believe that they are intellectually superior, that they are militarily superior, they have the nerve to believe that they are morally superior. That is, they believe they are God's greatest expression of creation, that they are the highest form of life that God ever created, and anybody not white is somehow less than human. They've actually articulated this, not their clansmen and their skinheads, but their highest intellectual minds that people still learn about in universities to get PhDs and masters have also said that. And therein lies the problem. How can you talk about the Tulsa massacre? How can you talk about the things that whites did to Native Americans and Indians that even the devil would have thought of? It contradicts that narrative of the white saviors. And I would like to, Mr. Washington, a portion of this discussion, if we could be allowed to ask each other questions, you know, kind of like if you say you like peanut butter and jelly sandwich, I would like to be allowed to ask you why you like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you know. So that's always a good part of communication, to kind of get clarity from the horse's mouth. But that's basically what's going on here. Now, of course, it won't be successful because black people have done an excellent job going all the way back, if we bring up Carter G. Woodson, to document and preserve our experience. After all, Carter G. Woodson organized Negro History Week that became Black History Month. Now, when I was coming up, we had Ebony Magazine in the home, and we also used to get these, there used to be a company out in Nashville called the Southwest Company. And the Southwest Company used to sell these two little handbooks. One was like a dictionary, and it had like the little presidents in the front of it. And then another book was a breakdown of different little subject areas. But they also started to sell these three-volume black history sets. And my mother and father bought that for us when we were small. So we used to, and we also used to read Lerone Bennett's book, Before the Mayflower, The Shaping of Black America. We used to read those things. But what is happening is many whites are fighting for the integrity of being white. And let me tell you what Donald Trump has given these white people to say as a defense. So let's say, for example, you were teaching about the domestic slave trade, where a million black people inside the United States were relocated from the Upper South to the Deep South as the expansion of cotton and sugarcane became very, very profitable. Where now, this is really the part where families really were split up, really were split up. So let's say you're teaching about that. So what the white person is going to say, you're teaching white kids to be ashamed of being white. And that's what's at stake. They are fighting for the integrity of their whiteness. So when you show on display what whiteness have done to black people and other non-white people, it is not a pretty picture at all. I heard someone on this show say, where would black people be without white people? And I chuckled to myself, where would white people be without black people? But, you know, this is the battle we have, information, correct and accurate information out here. So that's basically my take on this, that we will continue to teach the atrocities in the various formats our children will seek it out. And what I would like to know, Mr. Washington, there definitely is a contradiction between advocates of Afrocentric education and the promotion of conservative right-wing talking points. The two are enemies of each other. So if a person is advocating right-wing talking points, they have no credibility in the black community, particularly of participating in establishing African-centered schools, because African-centered schools do not teach people to devalue, do not teach black children that slavery wasn't important. It does not teach black children that when a black woman was raped by the slave master, she gave it up willingly. So there's some real, real house cleaning has to be done here. Okay, so that's the battle going on. The white folks, like they've always done, want to hide stuff. And then they trivialize stuff. I was on one of those right-wing conservative racist shows earlier this week. I called in. And one of the ladies, I like her. She's a white supremacist, but I like her. And the thing with them now, Mr. Washington, is everything that they don't agree with is communism. That's the thing now, communism. So I would like them to read Frederick Douglass and see what he said about slavery. I guess they would call him a communist, or he was influenced by Black Lives Matter. I guess they would say that. Harriet Jacobs. There's a whole field of slave narratives where they wrote about their experiences, and none of them said slavery was good. They told about how bad it was. That's the evidence you used. The words from the slaves themselves is what you beat an ignorant fool over the head with. That's what you whip them with. And some of these people, like on that show that I called in on, they have these people that are real religious, right? They try to talk about the Christian and all that. But see, with them, I just quote scripture to them. I beat them up with God's word to the point that they'll ask for the devil to come take them away. So I'll yield the floor. But, yeah, it contradicts the narrative they created about themselves. Mr. Washington, have you ever read 100 Years of Lynchings? It's a book that was an accumulation of newspaper articles about lynchings starting from about 1880 going up to like 1961. And when you read these articles about lynchings, you'll know it wasn't simple of just taking a black person and putting a rope around their neck. This was a whole ritual where the white children, the white ministers, they would even let the children out of school like a field trip. And then they would torture the black person, stab them repeatedly, cut their body parts off, burn their bodies up. Then when the bodies was burned, take pictures of it with their children, make postcards of it. And then they would fight each other for the body parts as souvenirs. Thank you, Mr. Washington.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We're going to go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, sir.
Hold on one
all right,
second. Say, John, hold on one second. I was getting a little bit of echo, and I don't know if anybody's hearing it. But before you come on, I just want to make a quick comment, say, John. And that is this, that because I work in higher education, my reading and my exposure to the discourse is primarily focused right in that area. So I'm not actually involved in doing very much reading at all concerning K-12 education or the issues pertaining to that. I would be very concerned about, and it does filter down to the K through 12 teaching experience and what the children are learning. But at the university level, what is beginning to happen that is highlighted by what's happening with Professor Nicole Hannah Jones at the University of North Carolina. And from what I'm reading, even though some of these situations haven't become kind of a news story, is that the professors, the particularly black professors, are basically being, if not warned, at least encouraged, if there's a better word, it might be told to tone down any type of instruction that may make the history of white America look bad. Of course, you've heard of the critical race theory, which touches on that, and now the 1619 Project. So normally, since the 1980s, the Nineveh, you know, were in college and graduate school in the 70s and 80s, and I'm still in graduate school and teach college history. But we became, most of us African-American historians, we teachers at the college level, became very excited about the ability to get our hands at that point in time on theretofore not very readily available primary resources. And we began to be excited about being able to delve into these sources and become knowledgeable about this history that we hadn't not know much about it before, and to share it with our students and write curricula to present this. And during the 70s and 80s, we were given a door to do this. And the 90s began to be somewhat a closing of that door. And then now in the 2000s and up into where we are now, it seemed like the door is shutting tighter, tighter, and tighter, to where professors who have a lot of this information, who have very, very comprehensive, in many cases, libraries to be able to develop curricula and to develop course materials, but have to be very careful, especially since many of these universities have developed over the last 20 years, 5 years. Some cases it may be less time than that, but 5 is about a good standard that they use. I'm not saying it's a good standard, but it's kind of normal. 10-year review program. So it used to be, from my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, anyone, that once you were given tenure, you had a sinecure, unless you did something that was fraudulent in your research or dishonest or illegal or inappropriate in terms of dealing with your fellow colleagues or students, you had a lifetime appointment. In other words, if you wanted to stay there until you were like Einstein in your 90s, you could. But now, at least at the University where I teach, every 5 years, your record of performance that has been observed by colleagues and by department chair and the dean is going to be examined to see if you've been staying in step with wherever the university wants you to go in terms of your commitment to whatever their agenda is. If you falling out of step with that, they will put you on a remediation program to get you back in step. If you resist that, rebel against that, they'll use that as grounds to let you go, even if you have tenure. So we have tenured professors now And of course, those on the tenure track definitely have to toe the line, because we have a history of very sharp in America and tenure track professors that don't make tenure for lots of reasons, but one of the main reasons, they just don't fit in with the majority white faculty in the department. They just, maybe they don't want to go to the socials, maybe they don't want to hang out doing the in between classes in the lunchrooms and talk about whatever the case is, or maybe their research is about something that the white dean and the white department head is not really concerned about or doesn't like. And so I'm saying this, and then I'm going to give it to you, Shake John. I just recently was required to present my doctoral dissertation topic to my chair of my dissertation committee. And I stated to this gentleman, who I don't know personally, but have been on a telecon, a Zoom conference with him, that I want to investigate what the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI were doing in terms of programming to disrupt white supremacist domestic terrorism.
Plain.
Because they do collect data and they do have inside information. They have informants and others that tell them what these people are talking about doing. They can't arrest these people for talking about that they want to burn up a black church. But if they talk about how they're going to do it and when they're going to do it, then they can be arrested for actually planning and conspiring to commit a felony. But if they just say, I want to burn up all the Negro churches because I don't like Negroes, the FBI says they can't arrest them because of freedom of speech, but they have data. So I wanted to see how much of that kind of data that I could get to see basically how serious the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security are today in comparison to how they were 4 years ago under Trump or 2 years ago under Trump. Is there anything changing? Because a lot of the same career people are still in place. Well, my chair, as I close with this, he said that topic needs to be investigated, and he supports me investigating, will help me. But he said two things. He said, number one, that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security files are classified, so they're not going to let you have that, but there are other sources that he's going to help me find where this information is open to researchers. It's not classified. But the thing about it is I want to put the finger on these FBI and Homeland Security people to show them that they may be actually not living up to their responsibility and leaving the door open for these terrorists to continue to do what they do. Not just plan, not just provoke, but to actually do the acts. The other thing he told me as I close is that he wanted to change the title, and as a doctoral candidate, if he wants to change something, it's to your advantage to go ahead and let him have his way. There are some points where you may be able to get some pushback from your own stand and say this, and I want to stay with this, and maybe you can negotiate that. But generally, when you're first getting started, and he and I just getting this relationship started, you have to listen to him. He said he don't want to use the term white supremacist domestic terrorist. You know, that white supremacist, he don't think that's going to fly with the people that's going to be reviewing this after he and I get finished with it. So he says right-wing extremists. Well, right-wing extremists can mean something entirely different. As I was speaking to my wife earlier, I said, you know, you have people that would like to see all the poor people continue to be on the bottom and the top cats, the trillionaire capitalists to be on the top. And so right-wing extremists could be those kind of people that want to keep the status quo and keep the poor people on the bottom. Right wing doesn't necessarily have to have anything to do with race, although some people think it may be appropriate for it. But I said, well, that's taken away from the real, real fight against white supremacy. But, you know, if I want to get this doctorate from this particular school with this particular chair working with me, I've got to be in. So, I mean, that's what's happening, unfortunately, is we who are in these white institutions as professors or in white graduate programs are being pushed to compromise, to basically bend in terms of the strong stances that we would like to take. And finally, I was told some years ago when I was working on a doctorate in another field, I would say, whatever you have a passion for, wait till you get that doctorate where they can't keep you from getting a doctorate, and then you just go full steam ahead and pursue it. But while you're in the program, just play the game, basically. They didn't use that word, but just roll with the flow. They didn't use that word, and try to get through it, which is not really a good thing, but this is what 95% of all the people that you see on the street or that you heard about, they have PhDs, have been forced to do. And it's getting to be rather sickening because it's getting worse. So didn't mean to give a long soliloquy, but Sheikh John Kenan, baby, you've heard a lot from Ms. Bianchi and Brother Warren, and a whole lot from me as well. What are your thoughts?
First of all, I'd like to say good afternoon to everyone. And Brother Washington, when your grandmother recommended these books, I think that everyone should read them. J.E. Rogers, from my understanding, when he went to Europe, he began to see the truth about our contribution to their civilization. That being said, what they're writing in books is not the truth, and a lot of it's untrue, I don't want to say lies, but it is fortified by having everyone honor them in a situation where they don't need to be honored. What white means is actually God. You're honoring them as a God. By definition, it means purity. And the best we can do to describe them in a physical sense is that they are pale skin. Now, as opposed to our people who have a hue, which is synonymous with humans, and he is without hue and pale. And then, but you're honoring him as a God when you call him white. So let's not do that anymore. If you were saying European, you're referring to him in an honorable way, as opposed to when he referred to as black, it's not honorable. But our people have to realize that the truth is not coming from those that enslaved us, that they have to have a change of heart, they have to change to make a big change. And that being said, they're resisting that. And where the truth will come forward and force them to recognize and admit that the truth matters, and they're resisting that. So we just have to develop the truth, assert the truth, apply the truth ourselves, and deny that the honor they want when they want you to honor them for what they consider the contribution they made to civilization. And like I said, J.A. Rogers, when he went to Europe, he found that the lot of contribution that they claimed were actually not made by the Europeans, but made by people of African descent. So as far as education is to, we need to return and speak within our history, our contribution. And when we do that, we'll find out that we are not the bad or weak or lower class people that kind of place us to be, is that when we find out our true place and contribution to history, we will find out that it gets reversed. We've taught civilization and civilized people at times when they were in bondage. So again, truth matters. There's a lot of resistance to truth coming forward. And that's what we should do, is seek the truth. Peace.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And now I'd like to welcome my dear friend and fraternity brother and mentor, Dr. Calvin Novus, who has joined us. And Dr. Novus, I imagine you heard probably most of what I said just before Sheik John came on. I don't know if you had read the topic on the marquee, but what we were talking about is movement to basically apparently muzzle the black professorial in terms of teaching things that may be uncomfortable for white scholars and white university the public at large here, that puts a bad light on the history of white people in America in relation to black people. And I pointed out when I actually started the program, the case that we talked about before, about journalist Professor Nicole Hannah at the University of North Carolina, and her tenure issue is getting a lot of publicity. But you may be familiar with all of that. I won't go into that particular issue, but I certainly am glad that you've joined. What are your thoughts?
Good evening, everybody. How you doing? I am glad to be online tonight. Before I get to the main discussion, Brother Kevin, I want to comment on something you said about your topic in your dissertation. I typically tell my students, do not worry about a topic early on until you get the dissertation proposal drafted. Then we can start discussing the topic, because one thing you'll know, and you already know this, your dissertation research will morph. It won't stay the way you planned it. It'll morph. And as it morphs, the topic will morph too. And so that's why I think it's important to start with, you know, a research question and a central idea, but be open-minded to that it's going to morph into something different. And
yeah,
the second thing I would say, go ahead, Brother Campbell.
Go ahead. Yeah, I appreciate
that.
I definitely take that on board. But the chair and I did agree that I would accept his recommendation, because we wanted the requirements in the proposal development course was to at least give a tentative title, but it can will change, I'm sure, and he's already changed it to something that satisfies him, and it may morph into something else. But yes, definitely, I'll take that on board.
Right, and another thing I want to say about the professor that was hired down in North Carolina in that position, initially she came on, she was not going to be tenured, but she is going to be tenured. There was a lot of pushback by a lot of people. And the one thing that schools have to understand, when professors move, especially professors like her, they come not only with a wealth of teaching experience and expertise as researchers, but they also come with millions of dollars. And because with her, with the 1619 project, she's coming with a grant, you know, that she applied for, that she still has, and the grant followed the researcher, not the school. And so she could easily leave University of North Carolina and go to, arbitrarily just speaking, go to Duke, and they will tenure her, and she will be able to invest those millions of dollars of that research grant into Duke's University. It's very advantageous to work with professors who have these type of large grants. And there's another story that's brewing that's very quietly. I don't think it's going to get the attention it needs, but a very prominent black researcher in one of the institutions in Washington, D.C., recently left that institution to go to another university in the Northeast, and this individual has a grant that he is solely focusing on research, and that grant is worth $25 million. And so he left the institution in Washington, D.C., due to some problems, and he went out to another very prominent university, and he's going to continue his research. This individual, is you see him on TV. He's wrote several best-selling books. And so, again, when it comes to academia, it's a different beast when you are a researcher with grants, because now it's like being an investor. You're not just coming to the school to teach. You're coming to the school to invest and to make the school better and to teach the students and actually get those students involved in some of that research. And one of the other points I want to make is that one of the most prominent researchers that we have on race in this country is a white professor. I think she's out of the University of Pennsylvania. It amazes me how we try to muzzle some of the Afro-American scholars on race, but she is doing a fantastic job in, you know, really highlighting race in this country, and she's not the only one. And I think no matter what we do, we would never be able to muzzle the race issues in this country because it has the interest of so many people. And when we talk about tenure is such a sensitive topic, especially when we start talking about minorities. We just saw, I think it was last year, the story last year that broke about this time, about two professors at the University of Virginia who had went through the tenure process and they were denied tenure. They were promoted to associate professors, but they were not given tenure. Well, a lot of the faculty members at the school, white and black, chimed in, and the school reversed this decision, and they tenured both of the faculty members. So it's a very finicky topic, and I will share with you all. I just took a new job at the Illinois Institute of Technology as a department chair for information technology and management. Well, I will be building that school's cybersecurity program. And one of my first agenda items was when I actually get there in August, is to write a tenureship policy. What's the policy on tenureship? What's suspected? What's the norms? We can highlight that. We get the dean to sign it. We get the provost to sign it. That becomes the standard. And that way, when somebody accomplished these things, they're tenured, and there's really no discussion about it at that point. And I think that's why tenureship evades a lot of people, is because it's not really captured in a way. But to sum it up, what all I said was that I'm just happy that North Carolina reversed its course, because I think that was a situation that would have gotten them in a lot of trouble and a lot of embarrassment, because you got a prominent professor coming in, she's got grants coming in with her that's worth millions, and you telling her she can't be tenured? I don't think so. And typically there's a gentleman's agreement when you are tenured at one university. When you come on to another university, you are supposed to be tenured. So sometimes that doesn't always work for people that look like us, but it does work for a lot of other people. And so tenureship is a thing that's really sensitive, and I think that the more we work to standardize policies on tenureship, the easier it'll be. It's not tangible right now. It's not something you could see or touch, because by keeping it somewhat we're keeping it in a state where people don't really know what it is, shooting at a moving target. You know, it's not clearly, it becomes unclear what the standard is. But I'm a fan of documenting the standard, working it out, and letting people know what they're working towards, because it takes the stress off them and it takes the stress off the process. And with that, I'll pass it back to Brother Cabinet.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation. I certainly want to thank you personally for that professional academic advice concerning my doctoral work. I definitely know that if I know anybody on this earth that's qualified to give advice in that area, it certainly is you. And so thank you for that. The other thing, too, since you made the announcement, I want to underscore what you said in terms of your recent appointment as a department chair at Illinois Institute of Technology. Congratulations. I mean, a hearty, hearty congratulations on that great achievement on top of all the other accolades that you very well have earned and very well deserve. So thank you again for that presentation. So what we're going to do, I do want to address one thing, and then we're going to go back in the other direction towards the co-host's final comment. Brother Sheikh John Kenan Bay had to leave us. That's where he dropped off. So after I complete this, we'll go ahead and ask Brother Warren for comments and then close out with anyone else that wants to say something before Ms. Bianchi gives us our final commentary. But
yeah, I want to say something before we close out.
We're not getting ready to close out. Just let me say this right quick, because I was in the middle of a sentence. I just want to address something that Brother Warren said, and when I finish, I'll turn it back over to you, Mr. Bianchi, for anything you want to say. But Brother Warren, now you had basically requested in terms of the show, I won't call it format, I'll just call it a protocol, that the panelists be allowed to, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm just interpreting it the way I understood it, to ask other panelists questions, and that's perfectly allowed. I mean, that's definitely fine. But the only thing that I have a real problem with, and I'm not focusing on you when I say this at all, is making an individual feel like they're being attacked or putting them on the defensive because of their position. I feel that I may have a position, which I'm just using this as a poor example. You know, I may have a position that all people that did not go to special college preparatory schools should not get into Ivy League colleges. Now, I went to a special college preparatory school, and I did get in, accepted to two Ivy League colleges. You know, so I might be prejudiced because I feel that that was a good preparatory program that helped me get accepted. So, but for me to make a statement like that because of my experience, that's just the way that I may feel, which I really don't. Trust me, I really don't feel that way. But I wouldn't want somebody to attack my feeling or my position or try to make me feel like I was wrong because I may sound like some kind of academic elitist or something that they may not like. And that's the thing about it. We may say things that other people may not like, but let people say things. If we don't like it, if I don't like it, that's our personal situation we have to deal with. But I don't want anybody to feel inhibited of expressing how they feel just because somebody else may say something that demonstrate they didn't like what they heard. And that's the reason why, yes, we can ask each other questions, but I just ask everybody to be civil and to be appropriately kind in your approach to trying to get information, not to try to put somebody on the spot. Not that you were going to do that. I'm not saying that at all. And I know you know that I am the kind of person that would not go there. But I just wanted to let you know, yes, we're free to have those dialogues back and forth. No. Don't ever think that we can't ask each other questions. I just want to keep things, you know, in a very congenial atmosphere. Is that okay?
If I could say something to that, Mr. Washington, I agree with you because for the sake of time. Also,
yes.
Panelists that's being directed to don't want to answer, they shouldn't have to answer.
That's right. We should feel that we don't have to answer a question and we don't feel comfortable with it. And I agree with you totally. So, Ms. Beck, you had wanted to say something else.
Yeah, I wanted to make mention, too, you talk about on the issue of history. But, you know, one of the things that always was that I was very curious in even coming up with electronics and, you know, physics. I was so curious, the things I've created as coming up as a young person, you know, building computers, trip computers for vehicles that would determine the ETA, miles per gallon left, and so on and so on. Before you started seeing those in the cars, the things that's available, you know, people say these things aren't available in order for people to carry out their research. But I could write to Texas Instruments, or at the time Electronics, and ask them for samples of their latest technology in the areas that I was working. I got from Electronics a 16 display 16 to play LCD readout, and I used that in order to build a trip computer. I had a van that I had voice synthesis that when I would say open sesame, a door would open. So those things are available, and I think they still as much as available today as they were then. You know, another point I want to talk about, you know, you talk about history. I was doing some research on the study of all of the black scientists that participated in the Manhattan Project. And what drew me with that study was Lord Quarterman, who was one of the scientists, Lord Albert Quarterman. And I was reading a letter that was a correspondence between him and Einstein. Quarterman was a physicist who came out of FEMI at the Columbia University and also at the University of Chicago Met Lab. And they was corresponding back and forth, and Einstein was agreeing with much that he was saying. But that was about 21 black scientists that participated in the Manhattan Project. And they worked, a lot of them come out of Columbia University, Chicago Metallurgical Laboratory, and also the University of Chicago. Many of them was focused on primary, on classified plutonium research. I had opportunity to meet Philip Emeagwali, the Nigerian who has been acclaimed the father of the Internet, basically because he was able, and Calvin, you may know about this, he was able to parallel computer processes together in order to quadruple the speed that we see today. And of course, that technology that he put out there has been surpassed. And the thing about his family is that his wife, Dale Emeagwali, is also a very prominent researcher. She came up with a method to determine the fatigue of material ahead of the time that they would fail. That methodology is used in the production and manufacture of such things as the wing on some of our aircraft. So there's a lot of scientists out there that, especially as blacks, that you can't get all in one book within your schoolroom setting. Something like that needs to be taken up on a maybe church, outside basis. You have clubs that have reading subjects that the club get involved in, and methods like that. Because to keep up with all the things that go on is just, you know, literally impossible. Me, myself, I was spared being drafted into the military because they basically said you need it there where you are. The industry I had letters written that told, well, it basically told the draft, the Selective Service, to leave me alone, basically. But I was happy for it, Mr. Washington. I didn't think I wanted to go there and be shot at, but I was having fun doing what I was doing. But there's a lot of history, and I think it's up to the parents to provide their children with that type of resource, the family, organization, like I say, ASCAT, National Black United Front, have wings that work at that very well. And that's, you have to call upon them for their utilization because it can't all be done in a school. And the rules in a public school is like this. You cannot present information to public school students that would basically disparage another group. In other words, you can't talk about, if you got a children in your school that's from a part of the Biafran War in Nigeria, it has to be put in context on the good things that the people done rather than the bad things, because things would, you know, would just get completely out of board. Now, it's nothing keeping from people to further investigate. That's what you're supposed to do. So I just want to put that out there.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Ms. Bianchi. So we're going to go back to Brother Warren. Brother Warren, for any closing comments or discussion that you may want to offer, we'll go back to Dr. Nobles and then let Ms. Bianchi make the final wrap-up comment. So, Brother Warren.
Yeah, I wanted to say, since I'm going to just quickly talk about science and invention since they come up quickly. Katherine Johnson, the last of the Hidden Figures mathematicians that died in 2020, her granddaughter lives around the corner from me. So I'm friends. I had a chance to meet Katherine Johnson quite a few times when she took visits down here to New Orleans. Secondly, I had a cousin. His name was Leonard Julian, and he lived about 70 miles from New Orleans, a little over 75 miles from New Orleans in the sugarcane country. And Leonard was a musician, but Leonard also invented a sugarcane planting machine. And in the 60s, he demonstrated that a process in front of hundreds of people. It was patented. And John Deere wanted to produce it, but Leonard did not agree with the John Deere name being put on his invention. So others copied it over time. Now, his invention is in front of a museum in a little town called Port Allen across the river from East Baton Rouge Parish. So that's in West Baton Rouge Parish. So Cousin Leonard invented a sugarcane planting machine. Okay, now, on the part about being allowed to interrogate fellow panelists is because we all want to have clarity in what has been said. A person put themselves on the spot with whatever they say, and then the person that's listening or receiving the message may not be clear and would like some clarity and some consistency on what was said. Now, let me give an example, Mr. Weisberg. Suppose you are bragging about eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Okay, you just say this a lot. You love peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. But I would hear you also say you are allergic to peanuts, and that when you were a kid, anytime you came near the smell of peanuts or peanuts, you would break out. That would be a great inconsistency. And I'd like to know at what point you started eating peanut butter for peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and at what point you got rid of your allergy to peanuts. Okay? So I'd like to ask the panelists a question. Is that okay, Mr. Washington?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly allowable. I mean, there's no problem with clarification. I think Brother wanted to make it brief. I think it's really what is the intent, you know, of the discourse, and the question should stimulate whatever that intent is. And I believe at some point, you know, we have to check our own self and say, well, you know, why am I really asking this person this question? Do I doubt that this person is telling the truth? Am I trying to point out that this person may not be telling the truth and make this person be seen to be a liar? Or is it that I just don't understand how this could be going on? The person who is allergic to peanuts is eating peanut butter and jelly sandwich regularly. I don't understand that. And maybe it's a logical answer that I can understand, but right now I don't understand. That's different than saying, I think this person ain't telling the truth, and I want to point that out. So I think as long as we make that distinction and we go in the positive direction, that's perfectly fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there used to be an R&B song that used to say, all I want from you is understanding. Now, that's all it is, to get clarity, understanding. So I'll pose my question to Mr. Bianchi. Mr. Bianchi, I've heard you speak over many times your work and the Independent Council of Black Schools starting, helping, or being a part of starting African-centered schools, communicating with ASCAC, the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization. And I'd like to know at what point you converted from the information that would have been disseminated participating in those endeavors to advocating a right-wing conservative perspective. At what point did you change and convert?
Well, I prefer not to answer that question, but in short, I made it possible or helped make it possible for them to be able to access and build to have that type of a school, African-centered school, to have that sort of theme like they had in Detroit and St. Louis and other places of that nature. So I don't want to get into detail on that.
Okay, but so you reserved the right to just refer to that information that would have been taught in schools as garbage and baloney, because that is what a white right-wing conservative perspective is, and I've even heard you articulate those type of teaching of the black experience as baloney, garbage, and junk.
Well, I don't think you heard me say that, but I can't determine what it is that you thought you heard, so I'm just going to leave it like that.
And I think, Brother Warren, that's a good place to stop that, because I can see where that might be headed, and I don't think it's going to end up in a really good place, especially as we get ready to end the show. But I understand where you're coming from, but I think we have to respect Ms. Bianca's right to get off the quote-unquote hot seat if he wants to. I don't think anybody should have to stay on the hot seat on this show if they don't want to be there. It may be an appropriate forum for that, but I don't think that Boogie Washington family room.
Well, Mr. Washington, I thought American patriots live to be on the hot seat, but that's just me.
Yeah, but, you know, if we go that route, you know, I mean, there are things that I might say that people haven't heard me say yet that might put me on the hot seat, and I wouldn't want to spend my 2 hours on Saturday evening, you know, being in that position just because of the way I may feel about certain things. You know, I may get on somebody's bad side if I tell them that I believe something religious, which I won't go into detail because I don't want to start anything, that they may have held dear ever since they were little children that I totally reject. And then all of a sudden, I'm the bad guy. So that's the reason why I feel that, as Ms. Bianchi and we have agreed, if somebody doesn't want to answer something, you know, let them off the hook. Let them not have to answer. And then that way everybody can go home and we don't have people mad at each other.
Yeah. Well, let me say this in closing. I appreciate that opportunity there, Mr. Weiss. I want to say this. I think that with all the books that are being published, there are outstanding, up-to-date research on the role of enslavement and the wealth that was produced for the United States. I think there's a plethora, well, not that I think, I know that there's tons of information coming out. And as long as that's happening, I'm not concerned about the attempt by people to cover up the ugly side of the American story. I'm pretty much confident that the genie is already out of the bottle, the toothpaste can't be put back in the tube. And so the attempt to go back to a Lily White savior story narrative of American history is over with, is dead. And those people who are fighting that are grasping their last breath to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to turn over to Dr. Nova for this wrap up, but I want to say this. My real concern as a university professor working in a predominantly white institution in the Deep South, and from what I have seen in my own work environment, it makes me feel somewhat uncomfortable because I believe that many of my colleagues and future colleagues are going to be put, if they don't bring large grants, gifts or large grants with them to assure their tenurability or their job security, that they're going to be in a very untenable position if they rub some of these quote-unquote white supremacist administrators the wrong way. And I've seen this happen on my own campus. And that's why I'm so concerned, because I don't like that. But we can't. We have a Black Faculty and Staff Association, which is growing. I remember when we only had about 5 members, which I was one of the founding members. Now we have about 40 to 50. We're getting new ones every month. All of these are not professors. Many of them are administrative staff or administrative staff. But the fact of the matter is, when we had a colleague that was, and I wasn't involved in the hearings about her case, but what I know, and I've been knowing this person for 20 years, who has done an excellent job, who's earned 2 graduate degrees since she came to the university, and done an excellent job in supporting students of all nationalities, but particularly the African-American students, because she was given that job to work with the Black Students Union and evolved into being the basic, what I would say, ombudsman for Black students, and then later the director of a culture diversity center, et cetera. But I don't know all the details. So I won't speak on that. But there was nothing that we could do to help this person who had worked at that university for nearly 2 decades keep her job when the administration decided to get rid of her. Now, yes, she was a very strong Black woman, and she said some things, maybe the way she said them, maybe had been considered being subordinate, I don't know. But not only that, when the students were going to hold a rally in the Culture Diversity Center and invited the press to come to hear them speak on behalf of this person that they admired, these were primarily Black students, the word was sent out to the faculty, we better not be seen on the TV camera at that rally. These are the kind of threatening overtures that I'm not going to say they're happening all over America, all over the Deep South, but I suspect that I am not the only African-American professor that's feeling heat because of this pushback that's being encouraged by the Trumpers towards us having the loud voice that we got used to having, particularly starting in the 70s and coming forward. And Dr. Nobles, maybe you know something about this that may give me some comfort, but I do know for a fact that we have got to find a way to turn this thing around, because what's going to happen is a lot of the scholars who need to be in these positions at predominantly white institutions who are qualified are going to seek positions that are not going to pay as well, and the only place they will be able to feel comfortable is back where we started, back in HBCUs, which is not a bad thing, but that's telling the person that qualified to run the 440 that the only thing they're going to let you run in the race is the 100-yard dash. And you know,
let
you
me ask you a question, Mr. Washington.
Yes, yes.
Before you say it at predominantly at PWIs, well, are they? Well, can they teach at the HBCUs if they? Wouldn't that knowledge be better served? I can't tell a person what to do, but I'm just asking. Because we know that when you look at research and PhDs, as far as Black students, their numbers of PhD holders is nowhere representative of their numbers in the population. So, and I've heard voices tell smart Black kids, per se, quote unquote, don't go to a white school, go to HBCU. They tell athletes to go to HBCU. So is that a tug and pull that's going on, or exactly what is it?
I can't really answer the question, but somebody had no background. So if you're not talking right now, your phone, if you know you got noise in the background, but I want to say this so anyone can hear it. I can't speak on behalf of what's generally going on, but let me tell you this. I'm an alumnus. I didn't graduate, but I have a good record at the University of California, Berkeley. Okay. I went to Berkeley in lieu of going to Yale or Princeton, where I had full scholarships. But I also went to two HBCUs. I went to Tuskegee Institute, then it was called Tuskegee Institute, and to Alabama A&M University, which is in Normal or Huntsville, Alabama. But when I retired from the Navy in 2001, I chose, even though there was HBCU right here in Augusta, Payne College, I chose to come to Augusta University because I knew that a degree from Augusta University would get me into the type of prestigious graduate school, Norwich University, which I have a master's degree in history from. I knew that because I knew the reputation of academic excellence and the high graduation rate, which really has improved in the last 10 years because of some selectivity that they included. And I wanted to eventually get my PhD degree in history from Yale. Now, I'm working on a doctorate degree from another school right now, thanks to Dr. Noble's helping me. But that's not where I plan to stop. I want to get my Yale PhD in African-American studies with a additional degree in general American studies. They have a dual track degree at Yale in those fields. And I know that with the track record that I have in my undergraduate studies, my graduate studies are two master's degrees, and what I hope to accomplish through this doctorate program I'm in now, that there will be a segue for me to get into Yale, because Yale, Harvard, and Princeton, and maybe a couple of others, are the gold standard in terms of history professorial opportunities. So all I'm saying is that, yes, many of us can move on and go to the HBCUs and probably will. If Tuskegee asked me, and I have been a visiting professor there on numerous occasions each year, you know, I do a visiting lecture at Tuskegee, or maybe more than one every year, depending on the invitations I get. But where I want to go, and I think anybody would have to agree, is where I'm going to have the most opportunities to be on the big stage. And maybe we may not be happy about it, but in comparison to Yale, Tuskegee is not the big stage. In comparison to Berkeley, Alabama A&M is not the big stage. Why does someone in academia want to be on the big stage? Because we want to share our knowledge with an audience that can benefit in a large measure, basically. You know, I'm not talking about getting more money. I'm just talking about having a large voice.
Well, wouldn't it be more conducive to bring those you mentioned up to the big state standards? And see, that's a hard thing to do. I know what you mean. I see what you're saying. You're absolutely right. People is going to go to a Yale or a Harvard because of the networking. And, man, that echo is something else.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I can understand what you're saying.
But Mr. Washington, let the record reflect, Mr. Washington, that Xavier University in New Orleans, the HBCU, sends more blacks to medical school than any other college. So I just wanted to put that record out there. That's all. Yeah.
I thought that was Morehouse.
At Xavier University in New Orleans.
Okay.
Well, let me say this, and then I'm going to turn over to Dr. I had also received a full scholarship to Xavier, and had I not decided to go to Berkeley, it would have been on my short list because I had graduated from a school that was founded by the founder of Xavier. Xavier was founded by St. Catherine Drexel, who also founded the St. Emma Mills Academy, for which I was an honor graduate in 1961. So I already had a very soft spot in my heart for Xavier because it was a Catholic school, and I was a Catholic, and because Sister Mother Catherine founded that school. So I will always have, even though I didn't go to school there, a special spot in my heart for Xavier University. I just wanted to let you know that.
It has a strong STEM program. It has a pharmacy school, and it has a very, very strong STEM program there. And I still did not get the information about who the football coach at Dillard was, because nobody remembers or knows, and so I'm still working on that. And I do remember Dr. Toler at Tuskegee that taught history? What is his name, Dr. Tolson or Toler?
Oh, Toler, T-O-L-A-N.
Yeah. He was like almost 100 years old when he died, I think.
Yeah, Frank Toler. He was the one professor. I got to say this, and I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Novus. When I was a junior at Berkeley, he was a visiting professor at Berkeley from Tuskegee on loan for, I don't know if it was a whole year because I can't remember that, but I wanted his class to be successful. And I recruited all my fraternity brothers, all of our lady friends, all of the other black Greeks that I knew on campus, and anybody else, African-American. We even had a couple of Jewish girls in the class. He had a full class because I knew him from home. I knew him as a child growing up. And though I never took a course from him at Tuskegee, I knew of his fame as an historian, and so I wanted to make sure that he had a very successful tour of teaching at Berkeley, and he did. So, yes, I'm very glad you brought his name up because it always makes me happy to hear his name.
Well, a good friend of mine taught at Tuskegee, and he said Dr. Toler didn't pull no punches. he loved Dr. Toler.
Yeah, he is spectacular. Well, let me just say this, and then I'm going to be finished and turn over to Dr. Novus. One day, even though my hope and my dream is to remain in residence, even as an adjunct professor, which I am now, at Augusta University. I've been here 20 years, and it's like my home. But hopefully one day, I hope to become a visiting professor or maybe an adjunct professor or in some way on the faculty of Xavier because I always have had that special spot in my heart for Xavier. So I'm glad that you brought that up. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, he's right about
that,
too.
One more question, Doctor. Where did Lena Horne's daddy teach? It was somewhere in Augusta. Lena Horne's, not her father, her uncle. Her uncle taught at one of the HBCUs right there in Augusta, I think.
Well, there's only one. That's Payne.
There's only one?
It had to be Payne if he was teaching in Augusta.
Oh, okay. I don't remember seeing Payne. It was somewhere in Georgia. That's all I remember. I thought it was down there.
Well, there's quite a number of HBCUs in Georgia, at least Albany State, Savannah State, Fort Valley State, Payne College, and Morehouse College, et cetera, those down in Atlanta that you're familiar with. But I don't know. I'd have to look it up. But if there are no other questions from the other panelists, I want to invite Dr. Novus to give us his closing comment and take as much time as you want, Dr. Novus. We've got about 20 minutes left before our time runs out.
All right. Thank you, Brother Kevin. A lot of good dialogue tonight, and I would tell you that when you ask a lot of black faculty members why they don't teach at HBCUs, I'm just going to be completely honest with you. They don't pay that well. They don't pay well at all, because I can tell you right now, I have faculty members that work for me. They make twice as much money they would make if they were working at an HBCU. And then also the school you're affiliated with also increases and enhances your chances of the grants and money that you bring into the school. I'm not dogging HBCUs at all because HBCUs serves a purpose. I just believe that HBCUs need a new strategy. They need a new plan. A lot of them need to update their curriculum because their curriculum don't really feed into the employment landscape that's driving the needs of jobs in this country right now. And so a lot of them have a lot of work to do there. If you notice, a lot of the professors that teach their HBCUs, especially some of our, you know, less prominent HBCUs, they're from other countries. And that's because you can't get professors in this country, white or black or any other ethnic group, to teach there because the pay is so low. You have to also remember that everybody that gets a PhD don't get that PhD paid for by the school or some other source, so they have student loans. So you're asking somebody that have $150,000 in student loan debt to come in and make $60,000 to $85,000 a year. That's shocking, right? When we really start looking at the numbers, I know a professor that graduated from a prominent university, Northeastern University up in Boston, just took a job at a PWI making $85,000 a year as a psychology professor. If she was to teach at an HBCU, she would be making less than that. So you're almost asking them to work for pennies on the dollar, and that's hard. And we got to change that calculus at HBCUs. How can they change that calculus is finding ways to pay, you know, these faculty members what other schools can pay them potentially, so you can bring in top faculty members. I'm just being real with y'all. That's what we're up against when we start talking about HBCUs. I deal with the same problem. I got a faculty member I'm trying to bring in, and I'm getting pushback because they say, "Oh, you're paying her too much," but she's one of the top faculty members in her field. If we want her, we have to pay her. She's not going to come and work below standard. Nor would I want that, because she won't be there that long. But if I can pay her competitively, she will be with us for a much longer period. And so it's important. Now you got faculty members at HBCU. It's hard for them to get grants because they are at an HBCU. And then you got HBCU, some of them struggling with their accreditation. It's almost like they're in a no-win situation. So that's why a lot of our faculty members who get PhDs from publicly white institutions don't return or don't go to HBCUs to teach. It's a hard pill to swallow. People ask me that all the time. Why don't you go to an HBCU? I'm like, you asking me to put myself on food stamps. And the HBCUs are not creative. They're not really creative. Now, just mind you, a few weeks ago I was a vice president in corporate America. Now I'm in a department chair position at the Illinois Institute of Technology. That would have never happened at an HBCU. They're not creative. They're not thinking, if I can bring business leaders with technical skills and credentials and put them in my leadership position, what that would do to my academic programs. And they're not. This school said, look at this guy. He's a VP. He got 26 years of military experience. He's a thought leader. He's a leader in cybersecurity. And look at his research. It's cutting edge. There's no way we should not consider him for department chair. Not one HBCU would ever consider that. Publicly white institutions are bringing in corporate executives to run, to be the deans of their school. Not because these people are smart academically, which some of them are. It's because they understand business, they understand how to bring money in, and they understand how to sustain the school from a financial aspect. That's smart. That is smart. A lot of these schools are failing. Let's be real about it. They are failing. So why wouldn't you change your calculus and say, what do we got to do to sustain our HBCUs? You got to get real. I'll be honest with you. Some of these faculty members have been around forever. There's nothing wrong with that. But you got to say, how do I get new leadership in here that's going to make us competitive? You're competing with schools that saying, not only do I want 30,000 students on campus, but I want 20,000 students online too. And I'm going to make it cost effective for my students, and I'm going to make it cutting edge for them, so when they graduate, they're going to find jobs. So my question that I ask HBCUs, what are you doing different? That's a question we have to answer. What are we doing different to attract and be competitive with other academic institutions? And when we talk about athletes coming to HBCUs, here's my argument that I make to that. That's a hard pill to swallow too, because For instance, if you're a five-star athlete and you have the opportunity to play for a Power Five in a Power Five conference where they have football programs that bring in $170 million, they got $100 million football programs, are you going to trade that to go to HBCU? It's different. There's a difference when you play at a Power Five conference than when you play at HBCU, where you taping the bottom of your cleats until where you got eight pair of cleats in your locker at any given time when you play at a Power Five, where you got the best trainers, you got the best weight rooms, you got tutors, you got the best physicians. We asking these young men to do things that most of us wouldn't even do. And that's why I get upset, because we're not being truth to the process. I understand what Deion Sanders is saying. Everybody is not going to be a five-star athlete. Everybody is not going to be a four-star athlete. But if you're good enough to play and you can't play anywhere else, come to a HBCU. We got somewhere for you to play. And these are the questions we got to ask. If your son was a five-star athlete that could go to a powerhouse, a Power Five conference, would you want them to play at Howard or Southern or Jackson, or would you want them to play at Ohio State or at Notre Dame or Alabama or Clemson? Because remember, these young men have the potential to make enough money, they can always come back and get a degree, always come back and go to law school, because some of them, do have the skill set to play at the next level. But are we going to jeopardize that by playing at a school with a program that's not going to help them get to the next level? That's what makes Alabama and Clemson unique. You can go there and play 1 year and get the training and the exposure you need to get to the next level. And that's what Deion Sanders is trying to do for the HBCUs. And I appreciate that. But I ask the question, if my son had the ability to play in a Power Five, where I want him to go to HBCU, and I'd be open and honest with everybody right now, the answer is no. Because we got to do the work.
You know what, Calvin? Calvin?
Hey, go ahead.
You laid it out. I really appreciate that. You're absolutely right. This has been going on for a long time. Matter of fact, I've heard HCBU people themselves say that they'll probably be down to 25 schools within the next, less than the next 10 years. So you absolutely, I went to University of Missouri for a baseball camp with my grandson, and they showed the weight room facilities, and it was immaculate. They even got MRI machines. They say if an athlete gets hurt, well, this is what they do, Calvin. When they come in, an athlete comes in, they are taken through a routine, a test, as far as strength, mobility, and if you get hurt, they will rehabilitate you to where you was at least what you were when you came in or even better. And you're absolutely right. These other schools can't do that. And we can't say that black children are not smart, although they're not breaking out who actually these blacks are. Are they Nigerians or who? Because we know Nigerians are hitting the scales off the chart. But looking at this chart here, the white rate of graduation, the black rate of graduation in Harvard is 98% for white, 97% for black. That's damn good. Down 1%. Down 1% at Rice University. Down 1% at Smith. So what is it that these kids are doing that's not happening every place else? And the thing is like you say, we got to get more of our young people. See, HCBU, Historical Black College and University, HBU, their professors have to go through a whole lot because they can't teach to the maximum of their ability because the children can't keep up. And it's really not the child's fault, because it's what prepared them for when they sat down at their desk in their college. For the sake of time, I'm going to let Mr. Washington take it back over.
Dr. Noble, I think you made a blanket statement about HBCUs. You have right at Southern University, they have an excellent engineering school. And those students are employed around the country coming out of Southern engineering programs. And so there are victories that are taking place at these HBCUs. In fact, many of the black students who they got black students go to LSU from families that could afford it. But there's so much racial hostility happening on those campuses, these kids got to go to Southern. And you have all of this taking place all over the United States. So that same hostility Mr. Washington is talking about as a professor on these predominantly white campuses are also happening to students. And so the HBCUs, those black students coming out of these HBCUs thrive. They are thriving. And so I just think that that's a blanket statement that's being made about HBCUs.
Well, I will tell you a running joke, and I will tell you it's a sad running joke, but it's the truth. Where graduates, engineering students or HBCUs will apply for a job and they'll tell them they don't have any jobs. Then you got black students that graduate from PWIs coming in and they're asking where you want to work, which section you want to work. And to me, not only is that demoralizing and wrong, and it's unethical and it's illegal, but it goes to show you that people place value on institutions.
Right, but that's not a bad reflection on the HBCU. That just shows you the continuing racist mindset that exists. That's what that is. But those black students, like at Southern and the engineering school, and I know about that because many of my relatives have finished from that Southern engineering school, and all of them are doing excellently around the country in various positions.
You know, if I could say something, I'm looking at the graduation rate, and Southern is 28%. And I'm not downing the kids, but here on the list, Grambling is 28%, Southern is 28%, Harris Stowe in St. Louis, I know that one very well, they 28%. You have Texas Southern is 12%. That's not good. Spelman is 69%. Howard 65, Hampton 59, and Morehouse is 55, Fisk is 52. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You got 5 schools that has a graduation rate above 50%. Now, there's other schools, there's white schools that's like that too, but that's not the concern. The concern is to get your black children up there. Like I gave you the rate between Harvard and blacks and whites in Harvard, it's only 1% difference. In some cases at Washington U, which is called the Little Harvard of the Midwest, blacks outgraduate whites at that school. So that's what the idea is. My grandson went with LSU. What brought him there? Well, one is because they put $100 million in their engineering program. And, of course, he loved the baseball team. Before he could get out of school, he had Chevron, BP, Exxon, and some private firms all emailing and calling him. So that's just the difference. We have to come to the facts. Nobody's saying this because we're evil. Out of all the conditions that exist, somebody is overcoming them.
The other part of that, too, is that when you have schools or you have the faculty member researching, cutting-edge research, bringing in grants, having those partnerships with corporate America, that's night and day. That's night and day.
Oh, yeah, it is.
And
because that student has the ability to put that corporation on the big stage. I got to get out of here.
I'm not putting down HBCUs. I'm telling you, HBCUs just have to change their calculus in the way they do things. I mean, like, I'll be honest with you.
And you know what else, too, Calvin? I understand what you're saying, but it started going wrong before they even get to the HCBU. It's going wrong down them elementary grades, sir. I'm telling you, I've seen kids in schools that did not belong in that classroom because they were just that much ahead of the rest of the class. They should have been put up in a higher class someplace else. And the parents are poor, but they sacrifice, and they do what it is. They made up their mind that my child is going to have better opportunities and success than I did. That's what you have to do. If you last, you can't be spurging. If you're last, and I'm not saying that in a derogatory fashion, I'm just telling you like it is. You got to work extra. And I'm going to leave with this. There's a university in China. The dorm goes out at 11 o'clock. The dorm lights go out at 11 o'clock. It's the first to say the students will walk out the building and go outside and sit on the curb and continue to study by street lights. You don't hear that kind of stuff in the United States. I don't care who it's from. There's some you don't hear about. But anyway, that's why they put out 10 million engineers every year, talking about the nation. And the fact that HCBUs and any other education is not up to par, it really gets down to one thing that's very, very critical. It's a national security issue that has to be addressed. Mr. Washington, I thank you. I'll see you guys next week.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bianchi. So we're about at the end. So, I'm going to go ahead and just and ask Brother Warren, he came on earlier, through the last wrap. So, Dr. Noble, I'll pass it on to you for any closing comments, and then let Brother Warren give final comments. So, Brother Warren, over. But I do want to say this. Somebody's got some noise in the background. If you can unmute your, if you think you might be the reason why the noise is going on. But it's on you to give us your final rap, Dr. Novus, please.
Yes, and let me say this. I'm not talking about HBCUs to be negative. I got my sisters went to HBCUs, and to be honest with you, I sit on two HBCUs advisory boards, and my goal is to bring new insight to these universities and these colleges and universities so they can be successful and to change the optics and change the perspective on the students that are graduating from these schools. But I would tell you, it's hard sitting on these boards. In fact, I sit on one board where they got a new president, and she came in and got rid of all leadership in one particular school. She just told them she's not renewing their contract because she was not happy with the progress of. And that's the type of leadership we need. When something's not right, do something about it. Change it. You know, I'm working with another small school. They don't have a whole lot of funding, and they got a whole curriculum based on an agreement with a corporation. That's troubling to me because if that corporation was to close or that corporation said, we no longer want to be in agreement with you, you got hundreds of students stuck in a curriculum that they can't finish. And so it's those type of things that's bothersome to me where you got to make better decisions. And I know that there are resource issues at concern, but again, we talk about how to address those things. And you got to take small steps, and you got to be innovative and creative. Instead of having, we're talking about bachelor's and master's degrees, you don't have to have a faculty of all PhDs. You can have a few PhDs, and you can have adjunct professors who have a ton of real-world practical experience that can come in and teach your students. That would cut costs for you as well. But there's some stigma. You know, HBCUs, I don't understand a lot of the poor decision-making. I'm not into their decision calculus. I just see it. I hear about it. I witness it when I go to the board meetings. And I'm like, I just scratch my head and be like, I can't believe this. And so I believe that, a lot of these schools can, they're struggling right now and deserve them. They could withstand some changes. I do believe HBCUs exist for a reason. I do believe what the Brother Warren said earlier. There are a lot of racial tension at PWIs. I got to come in and basically shake up my department because of that. Schools have to build a diverse workforce, not only for the betterment of the betterment of the student, but because you want the workforce to be representative of the student populace. And I just believe that there's a lot of work to be done. And so it's a trade-off. Do you want to come and deal with the racial tension, or do you want to go to an HBCU where you don't have to deal with that? There are trade-offs. It's all about how what the student really wants, what the parents of the student really wants as well. So to me, it's a trade-off. And even for those of us who are at public and white institutions, we deal with the same thing. We deal with the exact same thing when it comes to that racial tension. But it doesn't mean we should not be there. It doesn't mean that at all. And then that's all I have, Brother Cabin.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Novus. And so we actually run out of time, but not in terms of people who have already dialed in or who've connected via the internet being able to hear us. It's just that we run out of time as far as the archiving of the next few minutes is concerned. But I definitely want to give Brother Warren an opportunity so we who are on the line will be able to hear in the closing comments. You want to make sure. Brother Warren, I'm turning it over to you for the finality.
Well, thank you so much for everything, and this has been a very stimulating conversation. In my closing, I do want to change the subject. I read today about the death of a former Alabama governor, Patterson, I believe was his name. But what was interesting when I was reading it was that his father was assassinated. I think his father was attorney general or not attorney general. He's running for a state attorney or something. But anyway, what the reason was I was reading because he was trying to clean up this corrupt city called Phoenix City, Alabama. And I'm starting to do more reading about that, the fact that they had these rednecks and organized crime. That's beginning to fascinate me. But I do remember the story about Walking Tall Buford Posse or something like that in Tennessee, near the Alabama border. But I just read about that Alabama governor died at 99. And he also was the one I read where he outlawed the NAACP in the state. And I just closed with that story.
Well, I'm going to have to say this. I must tell you all this. I grew up under John Patterson, Governor John Patterson. And I remember the incident where they had so much violence and corruption in Phoenix City, which Phoenix City is just right across the river from Fort Bend in Georgia. So as many of these little communities or the towns right outside of military bases, there's a lot of prostitution, there's a lot of bootlegging, there's a lot of all kinds of corrupt and illegal practices going on. And so Phoenix City was no exception. But there was such a from the Army and also from the other residents of the community concerning what was going on that the governor decided to activate the National Guard to close down a lot of these places of ill repute and to keep the streets clear of these violent operators. And so I remember going into Phoenix City because my father being in the Air Force Reserves, he was an officer in the Air Force Reserve, and so he had an ID card which allowed him to go on the post. And unlike today, where the reservists don't really have the full benefits, his ID card allowed him to go back and forth just like he was a retiree. So he could go on post whenever he wanted to, and he basically would go up there to buy liquor from the Class 6 store, which is the liquor store on a Army base. But the fact of the matter is that sometimes when he would go up there, we would also go visit some friends that lived in the city. And so I'd be riding with him. And I remember seeing the Alabama National Guard
patrolling the streets of Phoenix City. And also, in closing, I want to say that in Tuskegee, because Governor Patterson had outlawed the NAACP in Tuskegee, there was actually a branch of the NAACP that was operating under a different cover, which was called the Tuskegee Institute Advancement League, something to that effect, Tuskegee Institute Civic Association, something like that. It was really the NAACP operating undercover. So even though he had outlawed the actual NAACP, they still operated. And so I'm glad to be able to report that. So that's awesome. It. Our time. If anybody wants to make a last comment, please go ahead. But recording has stopped, but we can still talk. You know, we can talk probably.
I'll end it now because I know if I keep on, you're gonna keep on too. So I'm gonna...
Yeah, but I mean I'm relaxed and I could talk, you know, for the next hour.
Yeah.
Just to conversation, but I know that others have things they want to do, and they would probably like to know that there's an end to the show going on to happen at some point. So I won't say anymore.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Good night, Mr. Washington. I'll talk to you next time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Nobles. Thank you so much for all of the help you've given me. And did you want to make any final comment for whoever may be listening via the internet? Okay,
no,
that's
no, I'm
fine.
Good, I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone who's been listening to our Booker T. Washington Family Room Forum this evening via the internet. We hope you'll join us again next Saturday. We'll be looking through the news, as we say, trolling the news reports throughout the coming week. And hopefully we'll have a very, very exciting topic to bring to you on next Saturday. So please join us again at 8 o'clock Eastern on next Saturday. Thank you again. Good night, and God bless you all.